This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations we want to have. The conversations we need to have.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
How is it even possible in 2026 for a Victorian AFL club to secretly make a player assume responsibility for his concussions? What do you make of that? In The Conversation Hour, we're going to look into this story that was in the Herald Sun this morning. Now, if it's true, we don't have any details about this club. The Herald Sun has declined to publish that. If it's true, how does it even happen in 2026 after all we know about the risks and about the legal responsibilities, the duty of care that we have assumed that the AFL has, that the AFL has also assumed, at least to the level that it has? What does it say about the AFL and its oversight of clubs if it is true that a club has been able to do this? What should players do you think? Should they stop playing in the league where this club is, if we find out about it, until this is sorted? My guest today thinks so. I'd love to hear from you as well. As I say, the club isn't named. We don't know what level this club is at. Surely it can't be at the AFL level. VFL? Grassroots club? What does it say about the culture of some clubs? Do you suspect this could be happening at your local club? The player was reportedly desperate to keep playing. He wanted to sign this waiver, and he acknowledged within it that he was already at higher risk because of his history. The club said, yep, sign this waiver, to say that the club and its medical staff would not be liable if he suffered more injury, more concussion-related health issues. I'd love to hear your thoughts about this. How is it possible in 2026? What does it say about the oversight of clubs from the AFL level, if indeed this has happened? I'd love to hear your thoughts. Also today, is gambling ad reform just all too hard? Have we just got to learn to live with what we've got? We're still talking about gambling ad reforms because we've heard that the government's proposed reforms are looking even more shaky today because the coalition came out against the legislation in its current form. It says they want the measures to be tougher, as do the crossbenchers. Our ABC politics team have said that they understand that Labor's willing to pack up its bat and ball, walk away from any reforms rather than have any substantial changes. Now, that, of course, could just be a negotiating line to push back against the coalition. Today, I'll be speaking to independent ACT Senator David Pocock about where this all sits today, what he would still like to see, whether the coalition will in fact back what he wants, what will happen to this legislation. But I'd love to hear what you think as well. Is gambling ad reform just all too hard? Are our politics just too complicated, too splintered for us to come to a legislative solution? What is the answer there?
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
Joining me now is Joel Bowden, who is a former president of the AFL Players Association and also former Richmond player. Thank you so much for joining me, Joel. What have you thought about this report this morning?
Good morning, Mary. And I was actually quite shocked when I was reading it this morning and thinking that this could happen in the modern AFL. I retired a number of years ago in 2009, actually did a study tour over to the United States with the Players Association, Auspices, of which I was the president of for a number of years. I went over there to do a study, and considering it's now 16 or 17 years since then, I'm sort of genuinely shocked that this could be happening and that an AFL club in the modern day would sign a secret deal with an AFL player. Can you confirm, or is it being confirmed, it's a current AFL club that have signed this player with a...
It is still... We don't know that yet, as far as I know. Joel, what we have had in that report from the Herald Sun is that it is an AFL club. It doesn't say about the level. It seems to have been confirmed as a case by the AFL Players Association. They've just put a statement out just saying that they're looking into the circumstances of this case and this is a quote, and to ensure that this issue isn't replicated further at the elite level. Now, that's ambiguous words, but like you, we're still waiting on details as to what level it's at. And in fact, to confirm that the story is true, I've already got texts, Joel, that say, look, you know, it is coming down to personal responsibility. Let's talk about that philosophically in a moment. But legally, we have come to a point, though, where clubs have obligations, as the Players Association points out, under the collective bargaining agreement and standard playing contract. There is a duty of care that exists with clubs in 2026, no?
Absolutely. There's also work health safety and work safe laws that, I mean, there is a duty of care. Clubs have what we know as the PCBU, which is the person conducting the business unit, to actually provide that duty of care in that safe workplace. Because ultimately, players are workers and they go to work. Yes, it's in an environment where there is risk. That's contact sport. There are rules. The AFL regulates that with the rules of the game, the laws of the game, the sanctions through the match review panel and the tribunal. So there are inherent risks in it. But to have someone sign a secret deal and get them to absolve them, the club, if it's an AFL club, of their legal risk, I actually don't think that it would stand up in a court of law, because it would contravene the duty of care that needs to be provided by the PCBU, which is the person conducting the business unit. I think AFL club executives and even AFL executives may need to look into this. And, well, they've got to step in. If this is true, and let's assume it is true because the Herald Sun wouldn't report it otherwise, well, I think there's a serious issue here, and the AFL need to act, and they need to act very, very soon, as well as the Players Association need to step in and condemn this practice. Secret deals are not okay. It's outrageous, to be honest.
Mm. You're listening to Joel Bowden, who used to be president of the AFL Players Association. As I said, we have asked for the current AFL Players Association CEO James Gallagher to come on, declined, but gave us that statement saying that the game has a duty to provide a workplace that that protects the health, safety, and well-being of all players. There is an element to an extent to which players are accepting there is a risk with this sort of game, obviously. But in 2026, what does it mean for the AFL's oversight of the whole league that this is even possible?
Well, it means they need to step in, Mary, and they need to do it immediately. The AFL Commission have powers to step in across the entire community football sector as well. So the AFL doesn't just govern the AFL at the top level that we watch on TV every week and we see these players do amazing and extraordinary things. They govern the leagues from Auskick all the way up. So if they accept this at the highest level, then it may be replicated at lower levels, and that simply can't be the case. You can't have players going out to play community football where clubs, say, wherever it is, in the country league or somewhere in Victoria, South Australia, Queensland, anywhere, that says, hey, you just signed this contract, and that absolves us as the club of any responsibility. So this is far-reaching and could have implications that the AFL have to deal with down the track. Like, when I travelled to the US and did this study tour, I met the NFL Players Association retirement fund manager. I'll never forget what she said. She said, the higher the cliff, the greater the fall. And if a club puts to a player who's desperate to play AFL football, that you sign this and you can play, well, it reminds me of the time that I had surgery on a broken cheekbone and played the next weekend because the club said, oh, it's up to you, Joel. You can play if you want to. You know, you've got a plate inserted into your cheekbone. How often do you get hit in the face? I said, oh, not very often. They said, oh, well, if you want, you can play. And, I say, of course, but I said, yeah, all right, I'll play. If the doctor says it's okay, I'll play. It's outrageous because you can't put that decision in the player's hand. I suspect the player who wants to play, whoever they are, is desperate to play, is vulnerable, says, yep, I'll play. And that's taking advantage of the player, or in the case of a worker, taking advantage of a worker who desperately wants to work, desperately wants to perform on the biggest stage, whether it's the MCG or whether it's at Docklands or at the SCG, that's what they want to do. Yep. And frankly, you've got to take the decision out of the hands, and the rules have to be set where there can be no secret deals, no signing secret contracts so players get to play. The more I think about it, Mary, the more outrageous it gets.
Yeah, and such a poignant detail there that the player was desperate to play, as you say. I will just point out to the people on text who are saying, look, is it AFL or not? It is reported in the Herald Sun that it is an AFL club, which means that, by definition, that means the highest level. Because I don't have the details, I'm not in the first-hand reporting role here. I was leaving it open as reported because it is still unknown. But, Joel, just on that point, if it is an AFL club, what are you thinking?
Well, the AFL have to act immediately. They have to make sure that this becomes public who's done it. The club needs to be made public that they have signed a secret deal with a player. If it's not an AFL club and it's a, let's call it a community club at any level, an Aussie rules club, the AFL has the power to act. And they have all far-reaching powers. I think conduct unbecoming is the one that they use for anything that isn't within the rules. So conduct unbecoming, and, you know, this will be contract law. It falls outside of providing a safe workplace. I wouldn't be surprised. Let's assume, or let's make an assumption, that this is in Victoria. Well, WorkSafe Victoria may need to be investigating this, because a club, which is a corporation, the PCBU, the person conducting the business unit, will be responsible for providing a safe workplace and providing that is not contravened by any secret deal, separate deal, alternative contract.
Yep. And we should note that we've asked the AFL for comment as well. They haven't yet. Well, Wal from Nagambi, what do you think?
Yeah, look, I tend to agree with Joel. I just think that if it's an AFL club, yeah, it's the top tier, but if by, you know, it's lobby journalism, the Herald Sun saying AFL meaning all of Aussie rules, it could be a community club. And if that's the case, quite often these clubs are struggling for players. So they're happy to forego any responsibility and put it back on the player because they need the players. Their teams are struggling. That doesn't make it right. I disagree with it completely. You should be able to say, no, you can't. But I know when I played, I would have, oh, yeah, no worries, I'll cop it, because you just want to play when you're playing.
That's what the players come into it. But then, what's the club's role in that?
A lot of clubs are really struggling now, and probably aren't thinking of the full ramifications, and they think we just need to get our team on the field this week. You know, there's numbers are dropping off Aussie rules clubs all over the state. Yeah. I'm not sure about the country, but you hear of clubs folding and merging all over the place. So it maybe just come down to they need the numbers and they think that they have to do it.
Well, that's really interesting. Thank you. And as a need to repeat, we don't know yet. It is not our reporting. It's reported as AFL. We don't know what level it is at, but as we're talking about, Joel, Wal brings up a really good point. If it is at the elite level, that is outrageous in its own way. If it's at club level, then there are those wider issues as well. Let's say, obviously, we're hoping that this sees sunlight and we understand who is confirmed to be part of this case. What do you think should happen? You obviously take a pretty pro-union role. That is your day job as we speak. Do you think the players should go on strike?
Well, we need to find out all the facts. And let me just talk about the concussion education program that the AFL run for all community clubs, and I've done it about five times now, and I know it well because Jack Riewoldt talks on the podcast webcast that they do. And very simply, it's if in doubt, sit it out. If a player has had a head knock, you have to sit them out. Like, that's the number one message that they put through. Now, if this is a community club, then they're not adhering to the concussion protocols. If this is an AFL club, then I think the Players Association should seriously consider what they do with their workforce. Because if clubs are putting players at risk, then the one thing that the Players Association has, and I've always been cognizant of this, the AFL Players Association is 100% membership. Mm. And so if the Players Association decided to do something, then 100% of their members would be behind it. And they need to seriously talk to the clubs and the AFL and even player managers who may be aware of this and say, what's going on in our industry? What's going on in our business? Because if it doesn't get cleaned up and cleaned up tomorrow, well, we're not going to put our players in an unsafe workplace. Plain and simple. And the clubs and the AFL need to understand that.
Mm. Just to finish on, Joel, I think I'm seeing some texts that talk about personal responsibility versus the law, etc. No matter what happens out of this, is it fair to say that our idea about culpability for concussion is still in flux in 2026?
Well, this might change it a bit. You know, in 2010, when Jordan Lewis got knocked out, and we all saw him knocked out against the Western Bulldogs and played the same game, that was a straw that broke the camel's back. I retired in 2009, and to think that we're still having this debate and that any club, any AFL club, whether it's in the elite or at community level, has asked a vulnerable player, a desperate player, to sign a contract, I think we're at a point where we need to have an open conversation, and whoever's reporting it needs to say who the person or who the club is, and then get all the cards on the table, because it's been evident in America, and I saw it in 2010 when I visited. We know about the incidences that have coming to the light now with class actions, and you know, Peter Jess leading some of that. My good friend Shane Tuck passed away, you know, before he should have. There's a number of incidents that have happened. Danny Frawley, who was a coach of mine, we know about this, and if this doesn't create a larger conversation and some action, then that's really disappointing, and I'd be surprised. But to wake up this morning and read the paper and hear about this secret deal, I was shocked, Mary, and I think it's outrageous, because we're putting young men and women at risk for the sake of a game, and that's not okay.
Yeah. Joel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Joel Bowden, former president of the AFL Players Association. And, of course, Richmond best and fairest. Great player, great speaker, tiger for life, says one texter. And John from Bacchus Marsh says what this club done is illegal and against the Workplace H&S Act. Jane in Narre Warren North, what do you think about this?
I just rang up to say that we've got two children that are elite athletes in different sports.
Mm.
And what I know about kids, and because we stepped outside our comfort zone, and both of them actually are competing in fields that we were on, you know, not familiar with. Mm. So you come in as an outsider, and what I can tell you is what I worry more about, more than an adult signing one of these contracts, is kids signing them, you know, young adults.
Mm.
Because I can tell you that a lot of them, they think they're going to the Olympics or they're going to be the next huge AFL star, and they don't think ahead.
Yeah.
You know, kids are invincible. They don't think ahead. We know that.
Yeah.
So they'll sign it, because they'll sign contracts like that. And a lot of their parents will sign them too, because parents are very ambitious.
Oh, that's a whole other aspect as well. I mean, from your point of view, Jane, you're just trusting that clubs and leagues take those decisions out of these kids or young adults' hands.
Well, that's right. I mean, I'm really of the opinion that you have to take a lot of responsibility for your own decisions, but when you bring into it young minds, you know, they're vulnerable, and they will. Yeah. They'll sign anything. They'll sign their lives away if they really think that they're going to make it.
Jane, thank you so much. It's really interesting to get that perspective as well. That was a very poignant part of this story. Keep those calls coming, 1300 222 774. We will want to keep on that story. You'd have to think there'd be some developments, some sunlight, as I said, pretty soon about what's lying behind that. Also, in terms of sport, we will be talking to Senator David Pocock about the gambling ad reforms. They're stalling, it seems, at the moment. What is going on with that? But coming up next on the Conversation Hour, Gen Z, young people, they're finding it hard to take up dental care because of all of those pressures that we face these days. But what are they risking?
Who will win the AI race? Has gambling become our national sport?
Questions. They've never been more important. So the one thing we'll never question is our duty to keep asking. ABC News. Keep asking.
on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
So it is Dental Health Week, and yes, it's always important to think about our teeth. The theme this year is My Smile. It's targeting young adults, 18 to 25-year-olds. I'd love to hear from you if you are in this age group, 1300 222 774. How hard is it to get to a dentist? Cost of living for everyone, let alone when you're a young adult, can mean that you put off the dental work. You think it's just not a priority. But what are the risks? Tell me, is dental care out of reach for you at any age, and how has that impacted you in your life if you have neglected it early on? Matt Hopcroft is Associate Professor of Professional Practice at the Melbourne Dental School and joins me now. Matt, thank you so much for joining me.
Great to talk to you, Mary.
Tell me, what do you think about the, if we've got young people listening, or someone who knows a young person listening, can you put into perspective what young people are putting off when they put off dental care?
It's a really good question, Mary. And like with all of our healthcare, the more that we focus on prevention, the better we're going to be, the healthier we're going to be. So one of the risks with dental disease is that it can be quite silent. Tooth decay can develop, gum disease can develop, and it's not necessarily going to cause symptoms, it's not necessarily going to cause pain until it progresses a long way, until it becomes a much more significant and much more costly problem as well. So one of the problems about avoiding care, delaying care, avoiding those preventive checks is that we risk more complicated and more expensive problems later down the track.
Matt, what do you think is the ongoing repercussion? What could we be seeing in future years, I guess, coupled with this? You know, how prevalent is it with older age groups? And are we coming towards a concertina effect where it's going to affect the whole population?
That's a really important point, and what we're seeing across the whole life course is dental disease is a really big problem. So from a very young age, one in three kids by the age of 5 to 6 have tooth decay, and it's the leading cause of preventable hospitalisation across any reason for our young kids. Adults, about 1 in 3 have untreated decay. Gum disease, about 50% of older adults with gum disease, and there's links now that we're seeing between gum disease and diabetes, or gum disease and cardiovascular disease, even gum disease and Alzheimer's, dementia. So that the sort of the broader health consequences are really important. And if we put care off when we're young, those problems become much bigger and more magnified as we age. And then what we're seeing is, you know, people really struggling from an affordability point of view right now. Last financial year, people withdrew $800 million from their superannuation to pay for dental treatment.
That it was accessed by people accessing super for dental work.
For their dental work, yeah. So through the compassionate release of superannuation scheme, we've seen that increase. It was about $100 million that was withdrawn in 2020. It's gone up to $800 million. I expect it'll go over $1 billion in this financial year because we have a government that doesn't fund dental care in quite the same way that it funds healthcare. So, you know, governments fund about 70%, state and federal governments fund about 70% of healthcare, but only about 20% of dental care. And a big chunk of that goes to subsidising private health insurance, which is really important, but it doesn't help to fund dental care for people on lower incomes and people where affordability really is a big issue. So we've got to really kind of try and refocus this government on thinking about how they expand Medicare. And, you know, they talk a lot about Medicare services and how they're strengthening Medicare, but the really big gap in there is that they're not doing enough to help people access dental care.
Matthew in Ringwood, what do you think? Hi, Matthew. What do you think should happen?
Hi. Yeah, I think that dental should be part of Medicare. It's just such an obvious thing, and I think it's quite a bit of a scandal that it hasn't actually been included in it yet.
Yeah, well, we seem to have been talking about it for so long, haven't we, Matthew?
It would be a boon for dentists, you know, like people would be able to go along every 12 months or 6 months or whatever they need, rather than putting it off for 4 or 5 years, simply because of the cost of it all.
Matthew, have you had that worry? Have you struggled to afford it?
I have struggled to afford it. I've kept it up, but I've struggled.
And sacrificed other things, I'm assuming.
Yeah, exactly. You're shuffling one bill to pay another, and other bills have to wait while you get the dental work done. But fortunately, I'm pretty lucky with my teeth. They're okay. But even just the consultation costs a lot of money. So,
yeah.
And clean and whatnot.
Exactly. Matthew, thank you. It is true. Those people who have good genes in this regard are thanking their lucky stars. This on text as well, Matt. My biggest regret is not flossing when I was young. Now 54 and two teeth have been removed at massive cost. I started flossing 15 years ago and stopped the decay, but the damage was done. It is just the simple things as well, isn't it, Matt?
I obviously am going to agree with Matthew. You know, all of us Matts think alike, I think. But, you know, the need for us, we have been talking about bringing dentistry into Medicare for such a long time. We had a Senate inquiry a couple of years ago. It made these recommendations. So it's beyond time for us to do that. But
to interrupt you, Matt, why isn't it? What's your assessment? Why isn't it part of Medicare yet?
I think you know, governments are worried about spending, and governments have always been worried about spending, and we're talking about something that's going to cost anywhere from a couple of billion dollars, maybe up to $5-10 billion. And it kind of depends on how you might structure a scheme. So I think that worries governments a little bit. I think we don't, and we see this a lot, you know, people don't prioritise oral health in the same way that they think about health elsewhere. So as a profession, we really need to do more. It's been resisted by the profession for a long time, I think since Medicare first started. You know, originally there were ideas about putting dentistry in, and it was resisted, but that's changed. We did some research last year, and, you know, about 60% of dentists now support the idea of bringing dentistry into Medicare in some way, because they see the consequences of patients not being able to afford care, not turning up as often as they should. So, you know, I think that the tide has changed. We just need, you know, some governments to you know, take the next step and start expanding. You know, we've got a great scheme for children, for people who are on family tax benefit A. So about 50% of kids have a Medicare funded scheme that's used reasonably well. So we've got a model that we can work on.
Mm. Matt, thank you for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Mary.
Matt Hopcraft is Associate Professor of Professional Practice at the Melbourne Dental School. This on text, I'm 83, my wife's 79, both been on public dental waiting list for over 5 years. We simply can't afford to go to a dentist. Another text pointing out that their kids at 27 and around that age still relying on parents. Maybe that's you as well. I'd love to keep hearing your stories. 1300 222 774 is the number to call. Now, coming up later in the conversation, the very controversial FIFA boss Gianni Infantino is still in his job, even after what he's been doing lately, but for how long? But talking about government reforms, or at least attempted reforms, are we ever going to get gambling ad reform? Senator David Pocock joins me next.
Did they mention your campaign? And I think more importantly, what we did here on Drive.
Charlie, they certainly did. So thanks, Charlie, and thanks for your help.
Charlie Pickering, this afternoon from 3 on 774 ABC Melbourne. On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Join the conversation. If you've seen the news this morning that the Coalition has said that it will not back this Labor's proposed crackdown as it stands on gambling advertising, what do you think? 1300 222 774. They're holding out because they're saying it needs to be tougher, as do the crossbenchers. ABC reporting is saying that the ALP is pretty much ready to pack up the bat and ball and go away if there are substantial changes that are going through. Is that just a negotiating tactic? What will happen next? Joining me now is David Pocock, who is Independent Senator for the ACT. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Mary.
So what is the situation as it stands this morning? We heard this about the Coalition yesterday, pushing for bigger reforms. You've come out in support of the Coalition balking, but what does it mean for the legislation?
Well, that's really up to the Prime Minister and the Labor Party. We had
2 days of Senate hearings into the bill, and it is very clear that it's inadequate. It basically is what the gambling industry said that they could live with, and it's not going to protect young Australians. It's not going to turn things around in the country where we lose more per capita than any other country on earth. And you have the vast majority of Australians saying to the parliament, do better, actually ban these gambling ads so that we can protect children. And I think if the PM withdrew his bill because the Senate wanted to actually strengthen it, it would show just how captured by the gambling industry our Prime Minister is.
You are pushing for a national regulator, a full ban, as you say, an end to also the inducements, harmful inducements that we heard some shocking evidence about this week. Is the Coalition going to support you on that?
I mean, credit to the Coalition. I think a number of people in there are doing really good work in pushing to strengthen the bill as it's currently drafted. You know, the Murphy Report, if we go back 3 years, was, I think, Parliament at its best. It was a unanimously backed report that had 31 recommendations. The three big ones, as you said, were a phased-in ban on all gambling ads, a national regulator, and banning inducements. And you know, 3 years ago, Peter Murphy, who chaired the inquiry, said, we have to ban inducements right now because they are the most damaging part of this whole predatory industry. And 3 years later, the government hasn't done a thing on inducements. And in this bill, they're not doing anything. So I know that is something that the Coalition has been looking at. The government has said that getting the balance right is having this opt-out system online. But it turns out, through the inquiry process and looking at the details of the legislation, that it would essentially require every Australian with any online account streaming service, you know, SBS On Demand, they would have to age verify themselves. And that is just a ridiculous thing to put on every Australian who doesn't want to see ads, just so that the gambling industry can continue to advertise. And so the Coalition has been talking about an opt-in model, which I think is absolutely the way to go if we're not going to go with a full ban, which would mean that if you do want to see gambling ads, if you don't mind seeing them, you could then opt in to see them and you could age verify yourself and say, yes, I'm over 18, you know, whatever the process might be. So, you know, I think those are really sensible amendments that I've heard the Coalition talking about. And again, it just shows how out of step the Prime Minister is with not just his party, but the rest of the Senate.
The ABC political reporting team is saying they understand, and as I was saying in the introduction, this could be just be a negotiating tactic, but they understand that Labor could just shelve it altogether rather than agree to substantially change the bill. Do you think that, from what you're hearing, is that true?
I hope not. I mean, yeah.
And what would happen if it were true? What would be the political cost, do you believe, for Labor?
Well, I mean, this is something that Australians want to see done. People are sick and tired of gambling ads. They see the impact that it's having on their children. They're seeing how normalised it is for young Australians. And then we're seeing the rate of gambling addiction and suicide linked to it. And it's tragic. If you look at a Prime Minister who will meet with the gambling lobby, meet with the sports, meet with the broadcasters, but won't meet with people who've lost sons, brothers, people with lived experience about the true cost of this industry. If they were just to pull this bill because they can't get their weak proposal through the Senate, I think it's a real slap in the face to the Australians who want more and to our democracy. You know, that's why we elect a Senate where the government doesn't have the majority. So they actually have to negotiate and the Senate can keep the executive in check. And I think we're seeing the Senate do its job on this one.
But do you think, I mean, you're saying that the Coalition's made noises, as it were, about the harmful inducements. Do you fear that the Coalition, in the end, this is just a bit of performative push and pull, and in the end you're not going to get what you need, you're pushing for, as you say, from the Murphy Review?
I obviously can't speak for them, but you know there are.
What would be the bottom line, do you think, that you would accept?
I mean, I think their proposal to have an opt-in online and to do something on inducements. I think, you know, these inducements, or, you know, the industry pushes back and say that they say, well, it's not inducements, it's generosities, which are these, you know, free bets, bonus bets. And all the researchers say that this is the most harmful part of it, because this is what keeps problem gamblers coming back for more and hooks people into it. If they're willing to move on those two things, this bill is a lot better. And, you know, whilst myself, others on the crossbench think that we should just implement the Murphy Report, you know, all this work was actually done. We have a roadmap. If they're willing to strengthen like that, credit to them. And, you know, they should be recognised for that. And I think it's something that the Senate would pass.
Mm. You're listening to Senator David Pocock. We're talking about gambling ad reforms. Just before I let you go, David, there's been some pushback from Responsible Wagering Australia. Now, that's the lobby group for the gambling industry, questioning why Luke Bateman, who's a former NRL player, if listeners haven't heard, he went and said to the inquiry that he got these inducements, but he did not say that he had 6 months' work with a New South Wales gambling company after he left the sport. And Responsible Wagering is saying, well, that's, you know, that shouldn't meet David Pocock's pub test, that David Pocock shouldn't have invited him to appear because he was compromised. What does David Pocock say to that?
Well, clearly the gambling lobby is absolutely clutching at straws here and looking for any way to discredit someone who, you know, was a professional athlete, would have earned a lot of money, retired with absolutely nothing, was like 250 grand in debt when he lost everything while he was playing professional rugby league. And then he worked for a gambling company, as you said. I didn't know that. But
should he have disclosed that to you?
I mean, potentially, but that's up to him. He was giving all his evidence, as I understand it, was when he was playing and his experience. I think it actually strengthens his evidence. He's, one, lost everything, then gone to work for this industry, knows exactly how it works. And when whistleblowers say stuff, we generally don't say, well, they worked in that industry, so they can't be trusted. We say, yeah, that person probably knows what they're talking about. They've been there. They've seen how it operates. So I don't really understand what Responsible Wagering Australia, I mean, the irony in that name for the peak lobby group for the gambling companies, is trying to get at here. The fact that he worked for a gambling company for 6 months, he clearly knows how it works and he's seen the damage of it. And, you know, I applaud someone like Luke who is willing to talk so openly about it, because the thing that I've seen over the last few years is the number of young men who've pulled me aside at functions saying, thanks for what you're doing on gambling. I'm addicted. I'm struggling. And the shame I feel as a man, because all the ads say I should be enjoying myself. Our culture says this is, you know, just a part of enjoying sport. But I'm just so ashamed that I can't get myself together and control myself. And, you know, that's the kind of evidence we hear. And yeah, it's no surprise. It is so hard to deal with an addiction where every time you turn on the TV or scroll online, you're seeing ads and you're being given these inducements through the apps.
Mm. Senator, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Senator David Pocock, Independent Senator, of course, from the ACT. This on text: horse racing gambling ads seem to get banned so easily compared to this. And a lot of support for David Pocock, pushing him towards being PM. Don't think he can do it as an independent senator, but there you go. There's a lot of love for that. Tell me what you think about gambling ads as well on The Conversation Hour. Ruby from Ballarat, we've been talking about dental work, how hard it is to get access to it. You've got some experience with this?
Yeah, I do. Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to share that I've been working less to care for my young children for the last sort of 5 years, I suppose. And during that time, I've put off much needed dental work, like a crown, a cap. I need a night guard and I think I need a filling. And I feel like my oral health has sort of deteriorated, but I haven't been able to sort of address it. Mm. So I'm planning to put my entire tax return towards just getting dental work done.
Yeah, wow. And when you look into the future, Ruby, is it sort of off-putting? Is this something that you're going to have to keep putting money aside for, do you think?
Yeah, it's just, I suppose I see how important oral health is, but it just feels so inaccessible right now. And, you know, I'm just worried that by not addressing those things, maybe they've become worse and what that might mean.
That's right. Ruby, very wise, the experts would say. Anything you can put in now in terms of dental health will pay off a thousandfold later. Thank you. And let's go to Kate in Pascoe Vale. You've had a similar experience, is that right, Kate?
Yeah. So I'm 30 at the moment, but about 5 years ago, I was actually told that I needed all four of my wisdom teeth taken out, and I was in a lot of pain, but I had to put that off for about 3 years because at the time I was quoted $3,000 for that procedure and I didn't have the money for it. And I kept putting it off until I got really desperate and I got a recommendation for an affordable dentist that had cap price in the CBD.
Were you in pain for 3 years, Kate?
Yeah. I was in pain for 3 years. And then I found that dentist. I went and got all of my dental work done I needed there for a cap price, for a third of the price.
Where's it at? Tell me, I mean, without a big, sorry for interrupting, Kate, but was it hard to find an affordable dentist?
Yeah. I had to, because I'm in Pascoe Vale, so I had to travel into the city for it. And I had to compromise on the sort of the type of dentistry that I would have preferred. They offer mainly to low income earners and they do basically cap price, or if you have private health, they'll do no gap.
So your advice might be to look around, keep asking.
Yeah. And since then I've been able to go yearly because they have cap prices on, you know, cleaning and things. But this really should be bulk billed under Medicare because we can only afford to go to bulk billed doctors now. And we've had to try and move all of our specialists under public health because we can't afford to see the four or five specialists that we need to see each year under private. That's $200 each.
Yeah.
Like, we can't afford that.
No. Kate, I'm so glad to hear you're out of 3 years of pain. My teeth hurt just thinking about your experience. And yeah, at least I think you've opened up a little bit of hope for some people. Potentially, if you can shop around, you can find someone if you're lucky like Kate. We are coming up to the end of the hour though, and we did want to talk about what's happening in world sport, because even if you were just hooked in by the World Cup, can you believe what's happening with FIFA? Gianni Infantino is hanging on by his fingernails as boss of FIFA. Let's see what's happening next with Ned Hall.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Well, just to catch you up, if you weren't aware, just really days after the Men's World Cup and all of the glory and all of the great morale that came from that, Gianni Infantino, FIFA president, pretty much pricked that balloon by suggesting that there should be some privatisation of the commercial arm of the World Cup. Well, all hell broke loose. There was a civil war. And now he has apologised, but he's still boss. Ned Hall is ABC football commentator and joins me now, knows all about these things. Ned, in 25 words or less, can you explain global football politics to me?
I'll just say no, to be honest. I don't think I can. It's in a very complex, difficult world, but Gianni Infantino, as you say, is still staying on in this job. Getting people out of the job of FIFA president is not easy. It wasn't easy when Infantino came in 10 years ago, having removed Sepp Blatter, who'd hung on to the job for an awful long time despite plenty of criticism from outside the organisation. But it's a tough job to remove someone from. So FIFA held an emergency meeting of its executive council overnight, and they've basically backed Gianni Infantino, despite one of the members of the executive council, Kevin Grafstein, having written a very critical piece in an internal memo, basically saying that it was beyond reproach, the actions that had taken place before this, and being very, very critical about Infantino, but
so
they've thrown their weight behind him.
So why?
Well, because I don't think it's as easy for him to be just pushed out the door. I think he has to resign for him to go at this stage. Now, he's up for election next year. If people want to stand against him, they've got to nominate by the 18th of November. At this stage, nobody else has nominated to stand against him. And the way it works with the FIFA Congress, it's one member, one vote. So all the countries around the world, however big and powerful they might be in a football sense or a financial sense, their vote counts exactly the same. So whilst UEFA have come out and said that they have no confidence in him, very few other people around the rest of the world have, and he's got a lot of support around Asia and Africa in particular.
Tell me what you think about what's happening at FIFA. 1300 222 774. Ned Hall is with us. So you seem to be saying this is a bit performative, this support, partly because no one's stepping up, and I will ask how tough a job and who's going to come in anyway. But you would assume that the knives are just well and truly being, you know, out scraping together. They're just waiting. It's a matter of when, not if he goes.
Look, I'm not as convinced of that. And okay. The reason why is because I don't think he should be staying on. And I think Luis Figo, who's a former Portuguese international who stood against Sepp Blatter and ran against Gianni Infantino in 2016, has already basically said it's too late to save Infantino and you know, it's not too late to save football. So there are a lot of people pushing for change. But a lot of countries have already said they're backing Infantino. A lot of African countries, I'll just mention one, Mauritania have backed him. Now, they are not a big, powerful nation. They're not a big, powerful nation in any sense and financially. But their vote counts the same as absolutely anybody else's who might want to vote against Gianni Infantino. You've got FIFA delegates and Congress members from all around the world who were put up in five-star hotels. They get about $300 a day per diem whilst they're travelling around the World Cup on the FIFA dime and living in luxury.
So they're just going against the hand that fed them and put them up in luxury?
Pretty much. Like, why do they want change? You know, from their point of view, I don't think, you know, I think a lot of people in other parts of the world have a very different view of how FIFA operates than some people with inside FIFA. And I think that is one of the big problems. Football around the world succeeds in spite of FIFA rather than because of it. And this organization made $10 billion from that World Cup and yet still didn't see that it was a bad idea to go and float this public-private partnership idea straight off the back of that tournament, which just looked like greed. And other people within FIFA have also said this is the works of just one man. So clearly the finger has been pointed at Gianni Infantino. And yet, within inside the organisation, people have rallied around him and said he'll stay in place for now. And what I definitely think he should go, and I think UEFA and the European nations are going to battle against him, I don't know that globally they'll get enough support and get the 106 votes they need from around the rest of the world to get rid of him.
Ned, as a lover of this code, does that make you despair? We've been talking about FIFA and this stink around it for ages. And what you're saying is, well, it doesn't matter because people with their, you know, with their hands in their pockets and their hands on their wallets, they don't care. And we just need to suck it up.
Well, you see, this is the thing about sucking it up. Unfortunately, for football fans everywhere, and I count myself in amongst this, football fans are stupid. They'll suck up whatever's being fed to them, in the sense that you want to go and see your team. If the World Cup's on, you want to watch it. So you're a very, very easy market and a very easy mark for whatever's happening at the top of the world game. And I don't think any football fans really around the world have any time for FIFA or any great love of what they do for the world game. Yet they're still there at all the matches. They're still there wanting to watch the games, watch their teams. So it's like a captive market that they've got. And as I say, it's a very difficult organisation to make anything happen in. You have to go back to that 10 years and everything that happened. I mean, an FBI investigation being launched into Sepp Blatter, and eventually there was a vote for change with Gianni Infantino coming in. Has it got better? Probably not. I think it's pretty much gone down the same path, you know, that was down 10 years later, and we're almost in exactly the same position where people want change, but I don't know that it necessarily happens at this next election next year. There may be a candidate that comes out that can really rally people behind them, but I'm not sure where that comes from.
Ned, it wasn't 25 words or less, but you did a cracking job anyway. Thank you so much.
Did my best, Mary. Thank you.
You did. Ned Hall, ABC football commentator, explaining the inexplicable world of football politics. Rebecca in Mount Macedon, really quickly, you have a comment to make about the gambling ads.
Yeah, well, the thing that I would really love to say is that this is a serious public health issue, and the fact that it sits with the communications portfolio, which is responsible for telcos and things like that, absolutely minimises how important this issue is. It has far too many connections to human misery, including people taking their own lives, to poverty, family violence, and much, much more pain, for it to sit within a communications portfolio that has zero connection to human health and well-being.
Rebecca, that's a really good point. Thank you. We will continue to cover that story. It obviously hasn't run its course in the federal parliament, but we will keep across that. Thank you to Rebecca and everyone who has joined me today. Thank you so much for joining me on the Conversation Hour today. You can listen again if you go to the ABC Listen app and look up the Conversation Hour and write to me, conversationhour@abc.net.au. Talk soon.